I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we've got a year in culture roundup. What's the best thing you watched in 2020? What's your favorite song of the year? Think about it and get back to us when a WPR reporter joins us to share his annual end of the year favorites list. First, for the last time in 2020, we're going to review some top stories in national politics. It is the week in Washington. And for the first time in months, we can talk about additional federal coronavirus relief legislation that passed both chambers of Congress and got the president's signature. Except the president waited to sign it before finally relenting. And in the meantime, people depending on federal enhanced unemployment benefits saw those lapse after Christmas. The future of direct payments to Americans is still in flux, and we'll dive into all of those details along with a few other threads that we're watching. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the situation and the tension between Congress and the president? What do you want to see your elected leaders do for people right now? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Mark Fisher is a Washington Post senior editor. He's also author of the book Trump Revealed, the definitive biography of the 45th president. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be with you.
Let's start with that coronavirus relief package. Things are actively happening right now. It's been months and months in the making. Finally made it through both chambers at the end of last week. What did it take to get things over the finish line?
Well, it took a certain amount of, it's kind of a dirty word in Washington, but bipartisanship and compromise, another dirty word. In a way, it was a hopeful sign about Joe Biden's vision of the coming year, in which he believes that there is some room for the parties to come together around really dire national crises, such as the coronavirus. So it took, after quite some negotiation, a lot of effort by bunch of moderate Republicans and Democrats, and they came up with this plan for $600 stimulus checks to most Americans. But then the president did his switcheroo, and the result is a bit of chaos in the final hours and days of this year.
Chaos to the point that, like, the president suggested it should be $2,000, and so House members got on board with that and passed it, and now the Senate Democrats are pushing for it, but the majority leader is blocking it. I mean, there's a lot going on Capitol Hill.
It is a very strange sight. You have, on the one hand, Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, Republican, who vehemently opposed even $600 checks for unemployment benefits just a few months ago. Now he is suddenly a big advocate for $2,000 stimulus checks after he'd made a brief stop along the way to attack Joe Biden as a big spender and demand that the budgets all be cut in the coming year. So there's this whipsaw action going on among many Republicans in the Georgia Senate races that are coming up next week. Both of the Republican senators, Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, have done a similar kind of whiplash where they were for the $600 checks. Now they're for the $2,000 checks after they attacked the Democrats as socialists for pushing for the $2,000 checks. So what we're seeing here is yet again Republicans struggling to show their loyalty to Donald Trump, even in his waning days in office, even as they are also trying to satisfy or serve their constituents who are struggling to make ends meet, who have either lost work or are on the edge of eviction. It's a really strange coalition we're seeing between Democrats in the House and now President Trump banding together and making life difficult for Republicans in Congress.
Let's hear from Senate Minority Leader Democrat Chuck Schumer speaking on the chamber's floor yesterday about what he and the party see as the importance of this larger check.
The fastest way to get money into Americans' pockets is to send some of their tax dollars right back from where they came. $2,000 stimulus checks could mean the difference between American families having groceries for a few extra weeks or going hungry. The difference between paying the rent or being kicked out of your home that you've lived in for years. It could buy precious time for tens of millions of people as the vaccine, thankfully, makes its way across the country.
Now, I hear Schumer there saying the fastest way to make a difference right now is to get these $2,000 checks to people. But when it comes to speed, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says there's no realistic path to quickly passing that $2,000 check in the Senate. A lot of discussion about timing here.
Yes, and Mitch McConnell is exactly right that there really is no way to get to where the president wants to go, given the situation that we have now. So on the one hand, you have the Democratic House will not buy the idea that the president put forward, which was to put the $2,000 stimulus checks together with two of his other favorite causes, an investigation into so-called election fraud and the idea of changing the laws regulating social media tech companies to make them responsible for the content on social media. The Democratic House, there's no way they'll go for that. The Republican Senate, on the other hand, won't buy just a clean, hey, here's $2,000 checks for everyone kind of move. The resulting stalemate, as McConnell points out, means that nothing will happen. And, well, nothing will happen means that what the president did the other night when he signed the bill that he'd called a disaster means that people will get those $600 checks and everything else, all the other issues, will be kicked down the road to Joe Biden's presidency starting next month.
We're talking with Mark Fisher, who's a Washington Post senior editor, also the author of the book Trump Revealed, the definitive biography of the 45th president. We're taking your calls on the week in Washington at 800-642-1234. What do you think is the right amount for direct payments that Americans should receive? Do you think that members of Congress should be moving as fast as they can to get that to people? Or do you see different ways for coronavirus relief? What do you expect of your elected politicians? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or use the email address. It's ideas at WPR.org. Do want to hear from Senate Minority Leader or Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell here. He was speaking on the floor of the Senate yesterday, and he describes kind of what you just did about these three elements that he says are linked together at the request of the president.
And the third subject, since every American, regardless of their politics, should feel the integrity of our democracy is beyond reproach, is exploring further ways to protect the sanctity of America's ballots while continuing to respect the federal government's limited role in standing behind state and local government who actually run elections. Those are the three important subjects the president has linked together. This week, the Senate will begin a process to bring these three priorities into focus.
Mark, do we know why, with President Trump on his way out, Mitch McConnell is sitting here saying we need to respect the fact that the president's linked these together and we're going to work on them together?
It's just a tool. It's just a tactic for delaying this. All McConnell has to do is delay this a few days, and then this Congress is over. The Constitution decrees that this Congress ends, and the new Congress begins. And when the new Congress begins next week, all the legislation that this Congress has been talking about disappears, and everything starts all over again. So he's simply making it impossible for changes to be made. And we have to go back to Trump's signing statement when he signed onto the $600 stimulus checks earlier this week. That signing is the bottom line. Everything that's happened since then is really kind of a bunch of noise. There's a kind of dance of like a year-end festival of cynicism that we're seeing here, with the Democrats sort of gleefully glomming on to Trump's proposal for $2,000 checks, even though they've never wanted to join hands with him on anything before. And the Republicans are torn between their sort of small government roots. So you have some Republicans saying, hey, we have to stop this big spending, even after they spent the last 4 years raising the national debt by a record 50%. And then other Republicans who are so driven by their loyalty to Trump and so fearful that he will gin up primary opponents against them that they'll go along with him even in this quixotic and cynical last-minute endeavor.
We hear some additional criticism of this idea of, you know, linking these together and not having a separate $2,000 stimulus check vote. And people say, you know, we need to focus on this. It needs to be clean. And yet in the major coronavirus relief legislation, I mean, it's anything, but there are lots of other things in that piece of legislation. What else did Congress vote to approve?
Well, just about everything. I mean, this is more than 5,000 pages of legislation. And this is what happens when you have a Congress that has been so dysfunctional for so many years, both parties, and they've been unable to move forward on almost any kind of legislation. So when they reach these occasional deadlines where you have to act on a budget or else the government shuts down, their tendency is to just throw everything into that one giant piece of legislation, and because they know that it has to pass or else the government shuts down. So they toss everything in there, and most of what's in there was put there by the Trump administration. And so the president then comes out and says that he thinks the bill is a disaster and it has all kinds of horrible things in it. Well, he's the one who put many of them in there, including the foreign aid that he's been complaining about so much over the last week. So it is true that no Congress member could possibly have read all 5,500 pages of the bill before voting on it. That's a fair criticism. On the other hand, that's how Congress has chosen to do business, because they're unwilling to come together and work more adroitly on individual pieces of legislation where they might have a more considered view of an issue.
We've got Tom in Oxford ready to join our conversation. Hey, Tom.
Good afternoon. Well, looks like you stole my thunder there. this whole issue, single issue voting, you know, that's what we need. We don't need these giant omnibus bills. And the whole idea that Congress can act in the way it does is not, I believe, what the founders intended. I think the system is so corrupt and far away from what, you know, kind of representation we need. It needs to be absolutely abolished and replaced. I mean, all of these people are in there for perpetuity. Look at this congressman who just passed away in Louisiana. Mm. He was being replaced by basically his office boy. Is that the kind of representative that those people in Louisiana really needed? Did anybody else even stand a chance of succeeding the congressman, you know, who retired?
Sure. And Tom, I want to jump in here because you bring up a couple of different points, and I want to make sure that Mark can respond to them. You know, Tom has some criticisms and is looking for single issue bills in Congress, wants to revamp the system. And we hear that sometimes from our audience, but when it comes to what's happening on Capitol Hill or in different pieces of the executive branch, there doesn't seem to be much of an appetite for changing the systems. Or am I reading that wrong?
Well, the system is not really the problem here. The problem is, you know, I hate to say it because I'm one of them. The problem is us. It's the voters. Mm-hmm. We send more and more extreme people to Congress because we're so frustrated with their inaction and dysfunction. And as we send more and more extreme people to Congress, they are less and less likely to cooperate and compromise with one another and get things done on those single issues that the caller's talking about. So this is Joe Biden's argument that won the presidency. So maybe there is an appetite for change. Biden's argument is, hey, we all need to make compromises. We all need to move toward the center. We all need to find practical solutions to really tough problems, whether that be immigration or the economy or the coronavirus. And so Biden feels empowered to move towards some kind of a discussion with his Republican opponents, and he thinks that he'll be able to get something done. There are many people, of course, who are very cynical about that and think that people are so polarized that they're going to, as Mitch McConnell said at the beginning of the Obama administration, he would do anything to make the president's term a failure. Well, you know, we've got a lot of failure around us this year, and there's a lot big hunger, I think, among Americans to see things get done. And the question is whether folks in Congress will be willing to do that.
We're talking with Mark Fisher, senior editor at The Washington Post. It's the week in Washington. We're talking about several national political stories, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about Congress closing in on overriding President Trump's veto of the defense authorization bill? How are you viewing the different parties in Washington in this moment? What do you think that they could do to change your life for the better? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We continue this conversation ahead on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. This is The Week in Washington, and our guest is Mark Fisher from The Washington Post. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What political stories are important to you as we close out 2020? What are you following closest? Maybe you have a question about what's happening in our nation's capital. We'll see if we can get the answer for you during this conversation. Call 800-642-1234. Hanging over all of this is this conversation about coronavirus relief is a national defense authorization measure. It happens annually. It always gets passed with bipartisan support, gets the president's signature, except this time it didn't. Trump vetoed it. What didn't he like?
Well, the president was looking for a way to make a bit of a splash on this question of he's railed for years against what he calls the endless wars. It's actually an issue on which he and Barack Obama saw very much eye to eye, the idea that they wanted to end the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. The president has felt very frustrated by the fact that he's been unable to pull all the troops out of those countries. And so this was a way of lashing out about that, in addition to which he's here again, he's latched the issue of social media onto his objections to the military spending bill, trying to push back against social media companies that he believes have been biased against him. And so he wanted to attach some legal changes, some additional regulation of social media tech companies through this mechanism. But basically, this was the president once again lashing out at the way Washington works. And what he ran up against is a Congress that doesn't do a lot of things very well anymore, but does manage to get the military budget passed every year because they see that as vital to national security and because they know that the military is one of the few remaining highly popular institutions in the country.
I mean, it looks like Congress is in a position to override Trump's veto. That would be a significant move, right?
Well, it would be the very first time that this president has had a veto over turned. And that is something that happens to all presidents a few times in their administration. So actually, Trump has gotten by, and it's an indication of just how loyal Republicans have been to him that they haven't overridden any of his vetoes before. But this time, there were very large majorities in both the House and the Senate, Democrats and Republicans coming together to push back against this president. And we've seen more of that from Republicans in recent weeks, in the waning weeks of the Trump administration. More Republicans are stepping out and pushing back against the president in some ways, even as they try to stay loyal enough to him that he doesn't lash out at them on Twitter.
Mark Fisher is a Washington Post senior editor, and we're talking with him on The Week in Washington, also taking your calls. And Charlie from Milwaukee is ready to speak with us. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. I just want to reiterate somewhat of what your guest had said, and what his comment would be is that I'm continuing to hear people talk about not supporting this president because they feel that the election was stolen. And I can think of one of the two greatest days that this country ever had was the first was when George Washington resigned his commission to Congress and gave up being a dictator, and the second being John Adams giving up the presidency to Tom Jefferson after he lost an election. We're a country of elections and people, you know, not be trying to be dictators or, you know, demagogues. And I'm just concerned that there's people, whether they like the result of an election or not, are going to cause havoc. And we need to unite as a country around our elected representatives, whether we voted for them or not.
Yeah, Charlie, thanks for bringing that up, because looking ahead to next week, we've got the formal step in the 2020 election process where the Electoral College votes are counted in a joint session of Congress. And we've heard for the first time that Republican Senator Josh Hawley from Missouri is planning to formally object to certifying those results. Help put this into context for us, Mark.
Sure. Your caller is exactly right, of course, that the peaceful transfer of power is kind of the heart of any democracy, and particularly ours. Donald Trump does not want to be the dictator, but Donald Trump has a deep psychological aversion to losing or being perceived as a loser, and we are seeing that at play now. The surprise, if there is one, is that we see senators like Josh Hawley coming to help the president with this failed effort to overturn the results of the election. The results cannot be overturned legally. The president either doesn't understand that or doesn't want to accept it, and the fact is that what Hawley will do is he will create a 12-hour delay, a bit of a show on Capitol Hill, because the election law provides that if a senator and a member of the House object to the way the vote was counted in particular states, they can say, okay, we need to have a debate about that in Congress. And so there will be a 2-hour debate about each of the states that they object to the count in. And there are six of those, so we'll have a 12-hour debate on the Hill, and then they will vote to confirm Joe Biden's election. How do we know that? Because the House is controlled by Democrats, and they will vote to approve the vote on behalf of Biden. And although the Senate is controlled by Republicans, there's a handful of Republicans who will vote for the rule of law and who will join with Democrats. And so they, too, will vote to support the actual results of the election. And that will be the end of this latest gambit on the part of the president trying to avoid the tag of loser.
Hmm. We also found out a member of Congress, Congressman-elect Luke Letlow from Louisiana, died of COVID-19 yesterday. He was 41 years old, first lawmaker to die from the disease, not the first to come down with it, of course. Do you have any sense of whether his death is affecting messages in Congress about the situation in this pandemic?
Well, we're seeing more and more support even from the biggest coronavirus skeptics in Congress on the Republican side, more and more support for the vaccine, more and more encouragement for people to get vaccinated when that opportunity comes along. But of course, there still remains an anti-vaccine contingent in the country, and how successful the government is at persuading those people to join in with their fellow Americans is going to determine how quickly we get any control over this virus. Mm-hmm. And so in Congress, has the tone changed? Yes, somewhat. And I think as the Trump administration ends, we'll hear less and less of this sort of official doubt of medicine and science. And at least Biden's hope is that we'll be able to return to a policy and practice guided by science.
Mark, thank you so much for being with us. Mark Fisher is a Washington Post senior editor and joined us for the Week in Washington. Coming up after the news, a WPR reporter joins us to share his 2020 in favorites from movies to songs, and we'll include you along the way. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Coming up tomorrow at 8 o'clock on The Morning Show, we're talking with a philosopher about what we can learn about ourselves and our world from times of trouble. And 2020 has brought us a lot of that. Join us here on the Ideas Network from 6 until 8 tomorrow morning for that conversation and more. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Lots of media sites are sharing best of lists this time of year, chock full of movies and music and books you may or may not have ever heard of. Why not make it more personal? Make your own list. Our next guest is a WPR reporter who annually makes a list of his favorite cultural things for the year, including movies, TV, books, albums, songs, and more. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What would you make your list? What would make your list for cultural favorites this year? What's something you read or you watched or listened to or played that's just stuck with you? Do you try to create an end-of-the-year list like this? Give us a call and share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Rob Mentzer is a WPR reporter based in Wausau. We've got a link to his favorite things of 2020 at wpr.org/centraltime. If you want to take a look, Rob, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Keela. Keeley, thank you.
Yeah, well, let's talk just about the concept of the list first. They are everywhere, and you put together a roundup of culture picks every year. Why did you start doing that?
Yeah, so to say an obvious thing, but a year is a very long time, Keeley. I think that it's like that's very obvious in 2020, which, we, as we all know, has been one of the longest years of all time. But I think it's true any year. Just a lot of stuff happens. And so to me, there's a sort of a there's a ritual to in December, looking back on the things you did in January and February and so on through the year. And you were in a different place. They came to you at a different place. And it's like it's a part of your life and what you experience. And so to me, it's like, yeah, it's something that I do every December. I'm not a professional critic. My lists are not like I do not claim to be, comprehensive. These are the 10 best things. I look at other people's lists and I like to learn about different stuff, different culture. But for me, it's almost like it's not a ranking or anything. It's like a journal, a way to like take a moment to reflect on what was meaningful to me and what I connected with this year.
I'm trying to figure out how this isn't work, because like if you keep track of it all year long, then it's always on your mind. Like, oh, I have to remember this for my end of the year. Look back.
Right.
But if you don't do that, then in December, like you,
right, you don't
so
know.
Much.
You 100% lose stuff if you don't write it down. Yeah, no, it's that's right. And like I know some people are very some people really get a pleasure in sort of like putting things in an order and like, you know, checking off their list or whatever. And I'm just for that's not that's a fine way to be, but just it's not how I am. For me, it's not like I'm going to conquer this by, you know, listening to 200 albums or reading 50 books or something. But what I do is I keep a Google document through the year and I just like make a little note of something that was meaningful to me or special to me. And I guess it is work, but it's like, again, it's like a journal. It really is like a way of making a note about an experience that I've had. And yeah. And like in the reality is like a lot of the experiences that we have are cultural products that we take in.
One of the sections you have does deal with books, and we've got Margie in La Crosse who wants to offer a suggestion for something that was important this year. Hi, Margie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What makes the top of your list for 2020?
Yeah, so I'm calling about a book that was published back in January, actually, but I just split it in about a week ago. The book is called The Overground Railroad, The Green Book and the Roots of Black Travel in America, and it explores this travel guide that was created for Black folks back in the 50s and 60s that was a list of basically places that were safe for them to frequent, right? And it kind of opens up this freedom of travel for Black Americans across the country. So it was something I didn't know existed, this idea of a green book. Was in publication for about 20 years, and I would highly recommend the book for anyone who is interested in learning more.
Oh, Margie, thank you so much for that suggestion. We will add it to the list. You know, Rob, I heard there Margie learned something new and it felt meaningful and relevant. What's one of the books on your list that hit you that way?
Super interesting. Well, so one of the a major book this year was the book Cast by Isabel Wilkerson that is maybe related to what Margie's talking about a bit, because it's a book about the Black experience in America and the way that the racial caste system and that is the word, and that there's Isabel Wilkerson makes an extended argument that is the right word for the way that that sort of racism operates in Americans. Really an interesting and compelling book. And I will say I read first The Warmth of Other Suns. I read this year by the same author, Isabel Wilkerson. That book is about 10 years old, but it has some explicit parts about the Green Book and about the hazards for African Americans like traveling across the country in the 60s and earlier during the Great Migration. And that was a really those are a couple of really compelling books that I would recommend for anyone who's interested in those topics, for sure.
WPR's Rob Menser puts together a list of his favorite culture things for the year, things like movies, TV, albums, books. And we're talking about what's made the cut in 2020. And we want to hear what's at the top of your list. Give us your suggestion at 800-642-1234. You can call with a question, see if we've heard of what made your list. Maybe you have a recommendation for music we should listen to that's brand new this year, or just something you've stumbled upon in 2020, even if it's years old. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Rob, before we move on from books, The Glass Hotel is on your list. It's also on the list of Shireen Seward, host of Route 51 on WPR. Why is The Glass Hotel one of your great reads?
This is a this is a novel about an isolated hotel on a an island off the coast of the west coast of Canada. And it's a really well made novel, and about family and regret. And it really is cleverly constructed. The Glass Hotel is the second novel by Emily St. John Mandel, the author, and it may be notable to folks. Her first novel was a pandemic book about sort of a post-apocalyptic landscape and a group of a theater troupe that was moving through a United States that had been devastated. So she's a great novelist, really, really good.
I'm just saying, maybe it's something about Wausau if Shireen Seward and you both picked
maybe it's a
central Wisconsin thing. Let's talk about some music here, because there's really great music. And one of the things that has come up repeatedly when we're talking to our colleagues is Fiona Apple and her album Fetch the Bolt Cutters. Let's take a listen.
I told you I didn't want to go to this dinner. You know I don't go for those ones that you bother about. So when they say something that makes me start to simmer, that fancy wine won't put this fire out. Oh, kick me under the table all you want. I won't shut up. I won't shut up.
So that's Under the Table by Fiona Apple. That's a favorite song on the list of Jennifer Dargan, the Ideas Network assistant director. And Maureen McCollum, who's the Wisconsin Life host and producer, also said some things about this. She says she thought it was the most important album of the year. It's a musical masterpiece and extremely relatable. Maureen says, I'm not very good at writing about music analysis, but the best way to sum it up is I feel like I've been waiting my whole life for this album. Wow. Like, such, it's really hit a lot of people in a lot of ways.
So I think Fetch the Bolt Cutters is a musical masterpiece. As with most things, I would agree with Maureen McCollum, but I also think that it's worth, you know, you have to consider this album came out on April 17th. So this was basically 1 month after we had sort of started to understand what the pandemic was in earnest. And we were being, you know, staying home, school was canceled, and all these things. And it was this really uncertain time. And so the pandemic has been hard in all kinds of ways. It's been hard every day since then. But those first weeks, we were all really getting our mind around the enormity of what we were going through. And then this record drops and comes out, and this is an experience that you can have at your home with just headphones on. And it really was like that was a legitimately big deal in the as part of 2020. And so I think that's one. I don't want to take away from the album itself. I think any year it came out, the album would be great. But I do feel like that is part of the emotional connection that I forged with this album, and a lot of people did. But it's great. I mean, it's raw and emotional, but it also has this sort of wryness to it. And this, you know, there's this bluesy growl that Fiona Apple can do, but also these very delicate moments is really good, really good.
We're talking with WPR reporter Rob Menser, who's based in Wausau, about his yearly tradition of writing a list of the favorite things that he's read or listened to, watched, and played throughout the year. And you're part of this conversation. We want to hear your favorites at 800-642-1234. What show or book or video game or album really left a mark on you this year? What did you enjoy the most? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. Our conversation continues here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Right now we're talking with Rob Mentzer, our rural communities reporter based in Wausau. He's sharing his tradition of writing an end-of-the-year list of his favorite media and culture things with us. You can join in and give us your suggestion at 800-642-1234. We asked Wisconsin Public Media staff for some of their favorites of 2020. Here are just a couple of them. Our technical director, Sarah Hopeful, says Glass Animals' new album, Dreamland, has been on repeat for me since it came out this summer. Jenna Rose Schleiss is a network producer for the Ideas Network, who included the album Gaslighter by the Chicks on her list. She says a whole album of angry singing about the men who let you down felt on brand for 2020, and I kept returning to it. If you have a suggestion, give us a call. You can stick with the music topic now, or maybe you have a television show or a movie or a book that has stuck with you. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Let's stick, Rob, with that music theme and talk about Taylor Swift. Swift released two albums this year, which surprised fans. One of those albums, Folklore, made your list, and so did this song off of that called The Last Great American Dynasty.
Who knows if I never showed up, what could have been? There goes the loudest woman this town has ever seen. I had a marvelous time.
Rob, why this album and this song?
So I like Taylor Swift. I think everyone should like Taylor Swift. And really she's just a very clever songwriter and a good storyteller. And that the reason that I like this song so much is it has a great story. It's a song about this wealthy socialite who had a bad reputation in the 1950s. And it's about the way that this woman sort of just didn't care how she was perceived, which is clearly something that Taylor Swift personally admires about her. And it draws you in. It's nice. The album Folklore and especially Evermore, this is Taylor Swift working with these indie rock producers, and they had a sort of slower and more ponderous production style. And to be honest, just for me, I wasn't always sure that always served her songs as well as that it might have. I like the sort of poppier, hookier Taylor Swift, I guess. But I do think that she's just a good songwriter. It's maybe coming out of Nashville and having the country music background. She knows the value of a good story song, and they work for me.
All right. We are making our own list here, maybe adding to Rob Mentzer's as we talk about what was most important or impactful for us in 2020. And we've got Caleb from Green Bay on the line. Hey, Caleb.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What makes your list this year?
My list for a lot of the comic book readers in 2020, the new Amazing Spider-Man run by Nick Spencer. He took off. With brand new number one, and it's been going hard. It's been going real good for those readers. I mean, the story's real good. He's bringing back everything that we used to love about the original Spider-Man and reading about his kids, and he's putting a little bit of extra love in there. So it's been a real, real blast for my 2020.
Oh, cool. Caleb, thank you so much for sharing that with us. We also had... Ben Curley, who's a video promotions producer with PBS Wisconsin, who touched on some books, including Say Nothing by Patrick Radden Keefe. So want to make sure to get those in there if you're interested, alongside that suggestion from Caleb. And let's also now go to Ellen in Cedarburg, who has something to talk about for the list this year. Hey, Ellen.
Yes. Hi. I know everybody's doing new things. I kind of was rediscovering John Prine this year with his very unfortunate passing. And I can't get enough of it. I just really can't. The person who answered said, when I said, I guess I live in the past, he said, well, John Prine is the past, present, and the future. I love that.
Thanks so much, Ellen. We appreciate it. WPR's Rob Menzer, what about things like Ellen's experience digging into the past and rediscovering stuff?
I shared that experience with John Prine, who was, to my shame, not an artist that I had a great relationship with or hadn't really listened to until he died. And then, you know, it was an occasion to learn more about his songwriting and sort of mourn his loss. He died of COVID-19. And he's great. His last album is sort of an album about aging and a meditation on that. He's just an extraordinary songwriter. Another one, a similar experiences, was Adam Schlesinger, who was the songwriter for the television show My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and the songwriter for Fountains of Wayne. And when he died also of COVID-19 this year. And that was an occasion to listen back to a bunch of his songs. He was a really good, great songwriter as well. And so it's sad, but actually that is a time when people sort of come together and appreciate these artists, what they've given us.
Rob, you also include some TV and movie picks. We've talked even on this program about, you know, TV this year. One of the shows that makes your list is the show on Apple TV called Ted Lasso. Let's get a small taste of this show and take a listen.
I always figured that tea was just going to taste like hot brown water. And you know what? I was right. Yeah, it's horrible. No, thank you.
Welcome to England.
I thought I was going to hate this show, and I love this show, Rob. What's it about?
Right. This is so Ted Lasso is about an American college football coach from Kansas who improbably is hired to coach a British Premier League soccer team. And I agree with you completely. It is a show that should not be good, but it really is. It really is great. It's a fish out of water comedy, like that clip you can hear. So he doesn't like tea, but he's in London, right? Like, and that is in a sense maybe sort of a tired trope in a way, but the show is just so delightful. You loved it as well.
I did, and I think that there's something like weird about it in that he's so optimistic, surrounded by people who have just like they lose a lot and everybody has ulterior motives, and he's just there like fighting the good fight every day with a smile, and it's like it's both draining and also kind of refreshing.
Right. And the show makes a point of not making his sort of optimism the butt of the joke. It is one of the most profoundly not cynical shows ever I've seen. It's like decency and good-heartedness can actually be rewarded. And so it was like, to me, again, to tie it to, you know, 2020, I would have been like, I don't know, writing a story about the 2020 election or something, and then, you know, depressing state of the world, and then you get to go into this world where being decent was actually valued and rewarded. And so Ted Lasso was an absolute highlight.
Yeah, we're barely scratching the surface with this, but Rob, do you create like to read or still to watch lists for the future? Do you have some things already pegged for 2021?
I need to develop my list. I'll just shout out one more TV show that I'm, because I'm sort of in the middle of it, and it is a show, City So Real. It is available on Hulu, and it's a documentary series by the filmmaker Steve James, who's probably best known for doing the documentary Hoop Dreams, which is extraordinary. And so this is a documentary about the 2018 Chicago mayor's race, you know, sort of nominally, but it's really about the ways that Black residents live in a different city than white residents in Chicago, and the ways that different political questions are perceived differently into different neighborhoods and so on. And it's really just a extremely compelling piece of documentary work in the form of, I don't know, it's like four or five episodes to the series. I'm two or three in, and it's extremely good. Well done.
Excellent. Rob, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your suggestions with us.
Well, thank you.
Rob Mentzer is a reporter for WPR based in Wausau. We got a lot of suggestions from the audience, so thank you so much for that. He joined us to talk about his annual end of the year list of culture things in 2020. We have a link to Rob's list set up at our website. You can find that at WPR.org/Central Time, so you can take a look, maybe write a new list of your own to kind of recap what's happened and what's affected you in 2020 and set you up beautifully for 2021. At our house, we've been ordering more takeout lately. It's this combination of wanting to support restaurants in our area and also the fact that it is exhausting to come up with meals all the time. Fast food may seem like a uniquely modern thing, but Pompeii has something to say about that assumption. NPR reports that researchers in the ancient Italian city have uncovered what is essentially a fast food place from 2,000 years ago. The food stalls were common in Rome. People have discovered dozens of them in Pompeii, but this is the first to be excavated entirely. Crushed beans were found in a jar, probably to change the taste or color of wine. Researchers found remnants of duck, goat, fish, pig, and snails in different pots. They say the storekeeper would lower the pots of hot food into the circular holes in the counter. Ash and pumice from Mount Vesuvius buried Pompeii nearly 2 millennia ago, and that ash killed hundreds of people who couldn't escape. I always think of it as like gray and lifeless because of that ash, but it preserved incredible pieces of everyday life. Archaeologists found ceramic jars and wine flasks and a drinking bowl. There's even a fountain. The food stall has these vibrant paintings, too, with depictions of things in real life. It's so real. It's really incredible. And for me, it served as a bit of a cliche reminder that even when things seem kind of muted or broken, there's something important about our humanity there, about recognizing beauty. I'm Keeley Boltina. This is Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.